5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
Think we could listen to the radio or something?
Radio? Who needs a radio?
Featuring the biggest names and newsmakers from the world of sports media.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Now, here's your host, the president of Barrett Sports Media, Jason Barrett.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. I am Jason Barrett. This is the 10th episode of Season 2. As always, I appreciate you guys listening and spreading the word on social media. I am back from a week on the road in St. Louis, Missouri. Had the good fortune of spending a few days with the crew at 101 ESPN, a station which I previously had the pleasure of programming and now assist as a consultant. If you haven't taken a listen to their shows, I encourage you to check them out. A few promotional items related to the website. If you're an imaging director or know someone who is and has aspirations to work with major brands, get in touch with me as soon as possible. I posted a listing on sportsradiopd.com and am actively looking for a killer imaging director. Also, be sure to check out the piece this week written by Monique Medina. Monique works in Los Angeles for iHeart and shared some great insight on why sports radio brands should be utilizing GIFs to enhance their social media presentations. Social media is an area I have a strong interest in, and I feel our format drastically lags behind in. So I'm excited to have Monique provide a few pointers to help my industry friends gain some knowledge, because this is as important of a space, especially when it comes to developing connections with your audience and promoting your content. So make sure you check it out. That brings us to this week's topics, and this is one of those times where I feel one big story needs to be front and center rather than five individual subjects with a smaller focus. So rather than rolling out a 5 and 5, I'm going to tackle one big topic with a few extra opinions and insights. So without further delay, here we go.
Quiet on the set. Can we please have quiet on the set?
Action! Over the past 2 weekends, I've found it less enjoyable to stay connected on social media. It began with the Jemele Hill story. Donald Trump's idiotic remarks added gallons of fuel to the fire, and now the trend has become to talk more about who's kneeling and standing for the anthem and the flag rather than who's performing on a football field. Regardless of which side you sit on, these issues aren't bringing more people together, they're not making sports more fun, and if anything, they're making social media more divisive and less important. For the first time in a long time, I spent the past 2 weekends not very engaged in Twitter or Facebook, and although at times I felt like I was missing out on things, I also discovered I can live without it and be just fine. As I've watched this story evolve over the past year, a few things have stood out. We often blame the millennials for everything going to hell in a handbasket when it comes to the media business, but if you look around the country, the majority of our sports media personalities tend to be older than 35 years old. You could probably even make a case for 40 and up. That means the cue for the majority of sports conversation comes from a large pool of people who are somewhat removed from their fandom and more interested in stories than they are teams, players, and overall athletic greatness. Drama becomes the number one attraction, and excellence and excitement from on-the-field activity doesn't move us emotionally as much. We talk a lot about the younger generation not caring as much about sports, and yes, they may watch it differently than generations before them, but if their on-air influences are more drawn to political discussions, dramatic stories, and detached connections to local market franchises and players, then how can we expect them to even be excited? If you turn on the radio, TV, visit a website, or scan social media today, all you're hit with is debate-style programming built around dramatic and divisive subjects. It's hard to feel enthusiastic and entertained when everything is serious and presented as an on-air argument. These are challenging times, in my opinion, for the world of sports because the focus is shifting more and more each day from on-the-field performance to off-the-field issues. And yes, I recognize that's happened before, but it's really been magnified over the past 2 to 3 years. I love the NFL. I've watched it for more than 35 years. but the past 2 weeks, it's meant less to me to watch than ever before. And it has zero to do with my beloved New York Giants losing back-to-back games on time-expiring field goals. The viewing and social media experience has been hijacked by who's protesting the anthem and who isn't. Hypocritical owners and a sorry excuse for a commissioner have tried to use Donald Trump's comments to spike interest during a time when game ratings have dipped. And by the way, some of these people are the same folks who contributed to Trump's campaign and have sought to avoid adding Colin Kaepernick to a roster. I mean, seriously, we're showing Ray Lewis take a knee on the sidelines in London after he just blasted Colin Kaepernick for taking a stand on television. We've got Rex Ryan calling out Trump for his controversial remarks, yet he introduced him at a rally, voted for him, and he built his own damn career off of doing the exact same thing. Come on already, this is nonsense. So there's no confusion when the president puts himself in the middle of a major sports story and every player and owner across the most powerful league in sports gets involved in it. Any responsible reporter, anchor, host, or play-by-play voice has a duty to mention it. That's drastically different than what transpired when Jemele Hill created the news with her personal opinions about Donald Trump. Nonetheless, when I tune into an NFL game, and I know there are many others out there, as well as some of you who are listening to this, who feel the same way, we're there to enjoy ourselves and forget about life's problems for a while, and we turn to sports to help us do that. I appreciate the competition. I want to see great teams and players perform at the highest level. Sports should be enough, and it is for many of us. It's the main course. Even when others in the same business would rather have the issues become that main course and the actual game serve as an appetizer. Whether you support the protests or reject them, the bottom line is that this isn't going to help the NFL increase long-term ratings, business, or positive PR when the conversation on every network revolves around who's sitting or standing for the national anthem and our flag. Ask DirecTV how that's working out for them with all their cancellations in the past 2 weeks. Call Budweiser. Ask them how they're feeling about their sponsorship after their phone lines have been flooded by people threatening to boycott the brand because of its association with the National Football League. We all have personal thoughts on these issues, myself included, but that's not what this podcast is about, nor is it what the majority of our sports radio stations should be consumed by on a day-to-day basis. Don't get me wrong. There are brands and shows that have established an expectation over the years that they're either known for being guy talk or a mixture of sports and politics. And for those type of programs, this is a gold mine. But for the remainder who have created an identity around sports talk, this is the equivalent of opening a steakhouse and adding pizza to the menu. Maybe you'll sell a few pies your first week because the customers are curious, but ultimately, you'll see a decrease in business because when you lose sight of your place in the market and fail to satisfy the customer's expectations, business declines. History is not defeated in that regard. Some in the media salivate at the opportunity to weave their personal political views into on-air and on-social conversations. Sports doesn't seem to interest them as much as real-world issues. They attempt to brand this moniker, "Stick to Sports," as if it's a bad position to be known for. When you build a career as a sports media personality, maybe, just maybe, think about who it is you are and why you and your brand matter to the audience. Many are losing sight of that due to growing older, watching, reading less about sports, and taking deeper interest in political real-life issues. But by going down that road, we're driving a wedge with the very audience that enables us to do what it is we said we love to do. And if that continues, you're just going to open yourself up further and have less of an audience and less advertisers. If those two areas remain challenged, you can add less job security to the conversation. When that time comes, then I wonder, how much will you miss talking about sports? Whether you agree or disagree, feedback is always welcome. You can reach me on Twitter at SportsRadioPD or by email at jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com. That brings us to this week's conversation, and I'm thrilled to welcome Bernie Miklas as this week's guest. Bernie and I developed a great relationship working together at 101 ESPN in St. Louis, and we've stayed in touch over the years. Without question, if you look at the history of St. Louis sports media and those who have made an impact, Bernie is right up there at the top of the list. This guy is an accomplished writer, a tremendous radio host, and I had the good fortune of sitting down with him to sort through the various chapters of his career and talk about a number of different aspects of the media business. So relax, turn up the volume, and take a few mental notes because there are a lot of valuable lessons to be learned in this week's conversation. 1, 3, 2, 1. Why don't we go back to the beginning, Bernie? When did you first start thinking about sports media?
Believe it or not, I was a kid, JB. I mean, we're talking 9, 10 years old. I used to write stuff. I'd come home from Baltimore Colts games or Orioles games, and I would like do a little write-up of the game for my father. He would read it. And, you know, I had a love of newspapers by then already. I lived in the Baltimore, D.C. area. There are 5 daily papers. So it was in my blood early, and I kind of had a sense – this is what I wanted to do. And it's kind of rare that you're that young and you kind of understand that already. And that really was the case with me.
So when did you get the first job? What was it?
I was 15 years old. Got a job with a weekly newspaper in Anne Arundel County. I was the high school sports editor and photographer. First of all, it was a great experience. The interesting thing about that, there were like 3 reporters on staff and I was one of them. One of the news reporters was a guy named, and some of your listeners will know this because he just put out a really highly acclaimed book, a biography on Richard Nixon, John Aloysius Farrell, who went on to cover the White House for like the Boston Globe.
Wow.
And he's written all these great books. He's traveled the world. He's a great journalist and writer. So it's like really funny to look about. Now, I haven't had the career he's had, but it's really funny to look back at that. You know, you talk about humble origins, but also not knowing where the road will lead. I mean, so here you have a guy who became a White House correspondent for one of the great papers in U.S. history. And then me, you know, for whatever it's worth, you know, fashioning a really nice sports media career that I'm proud of.
So you talked about the early days. You get your start in high school, essentially. When did you start really entering the professional world, major newspapers? Because I know you started in Maryland. You had your spot in Dallas, and obviously you built a couple decades of success here. But when did you really get that start?
I was 19 years old, and I screwed up in that the Baltimore Sun invited me down for an internship interview. And I wasn't able to make the interview. Now, it wasn't because I was screwing around. Something happened with my family, and I had no way of getting there. It was kind of an emergency. But they were peeved, so they canceled. They wouldn't let me reschedule the interview. So let that be a lesson. I guess you got to get there by any means necessary. I made a call to the just out of the blue, cold call to the high school sports editor at the old Baltimore News American, and which is the afternoon paper, and they didn't know me obviously, and I just said, look, I want to come down there and learn. I'll do whatever you guys need. I won't get in the way. I'll make myself useful. Blah blah blah. And he later told me his name was Jack Gibbons, who then, you know, from years later, he's just been an editor at the Philadelphia Daily News, a really, really great guy. He told me later, he said, you know, I get those calls all the time. And he said, there was something about you. I could tell you really meant it. And it was kind of funny to me. So I said, yeah, we got to bring this this main maniac down here. And so my philosophy as a 19-year-old kid in this major city newsroom was to make myself as useful as possible. I mean, just be, in effect, indispensable. And no job was too small or minor. Certainly nothing was beneath me. If they wanted me to get coffee, I'd go get coffee.
Mm-hmm.
If one of the editors wanted a turkey sandwich from across the street, no problem. I'll be back in 5 minutes. Answering the phones, running race results upstairs, all of it. But then they said, well, you know, he seems like he's got a decent head on his shoulders. Let's give him a little more. And so they let me do this and let me do that. And then one time I kind of earned some trust, and I think you know this story, but I'll remind you anyway. I recognized an opportunity, you know, and I'm one of those guys, I was always going to press it without being annoying, but I was always going to press it if I had an opportunity. Gordie Howe was playing a hockey game with the Hartford Whalers at the Capitol Center outside of Washington, and the guy I was assigned to it was sick, and he couldn't go. So I went to the editor, and I said, well, let me go cover this. It's Gordie Howe's last visit. And, you know, we should have a story. He says, look, you're too young to write. We can't, you know, no offense, but you need more experience. I said, look, give me the credential. Let me go. I'll turn it in. If it's terrible or it's beneath your standards, don't run it. don't run it. And I won't, no offense, I won't be mad or upset. I know I got to make good. So I went and covered a game, interviewed Gordie Howe, wrote the piece, and they thought it was solid enough.
Mm-hmm.
He pointed out a couple cliches. And so they were like, okay, well, we got a minor league hockey team here, so let's put the kid on that. And so I took that over. So I'm rambling here, but my point is that as a young guy, I was extremely hardworking, industrious, made myself indispensable. When there was an opportunity there, I tried to take advantage of it. And I really wanted to make myself someone who's known as, like, you can trust this guy. He's versatile. He's reliable. He works his tail off. So I started as a 19-year-old intern there, just off the streets, cold calling them to get in the door. By the time I left that place at age 24, I was a columnist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I covered the NFL. I helped out on the Orioles beat, Maryland, Navy, you know. So from 19, I go from a guy off the street making minimum wage to writing a column at a major city daily. I probably wasn't ready for that, mm-hmm. but again, invaluable experience. And I was really proud that I was able to do that, you know.
Yeah.
I guess at the time I didn't really understand it's not supposed to happen that quickly.
Right.
So yeah,
when you're in this business, you don't expect how it's gonna go. Like,
right.
I did the same thing, knocking on doors to get an internship in radio. I had no idea I was gonna be running a radio station one day, or being a consultant, or, you know, doing the things I've done. It's just, you just go, and if you're driven,
exactly.
you get there, you know.
Yeah. And I don't look, man, I don't want to sound like the old fart. I'm not like that at all, lecturing the kids. I'm not that at all. But, you know, I really think, especially in, you know, this multimedia age where there's so many platforms and there's so many hills to climb, but there's also so many opportunities, whether it be make your mark on social media or a blog or video, anything we could name. And I mean, look at, you and I were talking the other day, look at the immense success of something like Barstool Sports, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the lessons still apply. I mean,
right.
we're talking about, this all happened with me, you know, like between 1979 and 1984. And, you know, some of the things that got me up the ladder there very quickly still apply today. They're
correct.
Still relevant.
Yep.
Be industrious. Find your niche. Find a way where people say, yeah, that guy can help me. You're not going to get anything by just kind of laying back and waiting for something to come to you. You have to be aggressive. Aggressive without being obnoxious, or where you're like, man, will this guy leave me alone? But, you know, there's still something about that kind of roll your sleeves up mentality that you can sort of create your own opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really can. It's a little harder now because it's so crowded out there. You have to come up with an interesting idea or something that's creative or something that hadn't been done before. But there's always a chance if you really, really, you know, lock in on the creative process, and also you have the work ethic and ambition to match.
With someone who's built the career that you have as a writer, I'm curious, because now writing, and you and I talked about this a little bit the other day, as someone who writes about media, which is a very niche thing, and there's days where I'm on a roll and there's a day I can't find anything to write about. Talk to me about writing on a deadline, the first time that you're tasked with, got to have it in at this time, and you're trying to, you know,
yeah.
being creative, but being creative inside of a space of time is really difficult. You've got it in your head, I've got to have it out at this time. It's got to be excellent, but at the same time, what if it's not?
As you know, we work together. We've been friends for a long time. I'm awfully hard on myself, actually. I'll tell you 30,000 things wrong with me. When I was doing newspapers, and you did have night games, and think about all the things here in St. Louis, especially, you know, the Cardinals in postseason all the time. The Blues in the playoffs. I mean, these are night games. There's deadline. There's pressure. For some reason, I thrived on it. I welcomed it. And maybe that was the key. I viewed it as a test. I viewed it as like a direct reflection on my ability to handle pressure, but also to put something out that's worthwhile. And this will sound hokey as hell, but I looked at it as if, like, this is my equivalent of coming up to the plate. There's two outs in the bottom of the ninth. You got a runner in scoring position, you know,
right.
that because it's a different thing, obviously, but it's still pressure. I used to kick ass, frankly. Remember the famous Fab Five North Carolina NCAA championship with Chris Webber with the
right.
timeout?
Yep.
All right, I turned that thing around, and I can't even tell you how many minutes. I think I wrote a whole column in 15 to 20 minutes. The editor of the paper, who, by the way, wasn't someone who thought I was like some devious person, he actually, you know, had a meeting the next morning, and he said, like, when did he file this? And what, blah, blah, blah. He said, that's impossible. That's impossible. And it was in the first edition. How did he do this? And the guy said, look, I hate to say it, are you sure he didn't, like, lift this from somewhere? No, he's a maniac. He's great on deadlines. So I always looked at it. One of my favorite stories, man, I hate to ramble, it's story time here, but my late great friend Brian Burwell, we're in Houston. It's the famous Albert Pujols home run. It's the National League Championship Series 2005. Cardinals were dead, eliminated. And Pujols hits this bomb off Brad Lidge that I think it's still traveling. Our editor on site's hollering at us, you got to file now, you got to file. And we're like, are you crazy? And we're like, give us 15 minutes, we'll get it in. And we did it, and we were just sitting there laughing. And I'm telling you, the editor, who's a really good guy, he thought we were just had lost our minds. They're like, why are they laughing? And I said, because this is what we got in the business for. Big story, big moment, right. Deadline pressure. Let's go, let's get this thing done. And those are the things that you remember. I mean, they really, really were special experiences. Because I got into this thing because you never had to truly grow up. I mean, you could go to the circus every day. You walk in an arena. You walk into a stadium. There's a chance you're going to see something you've never seen before.
Right.
Even if you're in a business 30 years, 40 years, that day might be something you've never seen before.
Yeah.
And I always tell people, I got in this business to chronicle success. People think media people look for negative stuff. Look, if it's got to be negative, it's negative. I didn't get into this business to chronicle failure. I mean, I want to see greatness. And, yeah. And that's one of the things in my career that's probably given me the most satisfaction. All the things that I've been able to cover and write about and see with my own eyes. You know, being, you know, several feet away, being 50 feet away from Jordan hitting a game-winning shot in Utah.
Right.
With the move on Byron Russell. You know, Montana leaving the 49ers down the field with the pass to John Taylor to beat the Bengals at the end. I mean, Kurt Warner. I mean, on and on and on. I could sit here forever.
Mm-hmm.
A million things that are just have been amazing experiences.
So you spent a long time with the Post-Dispatch, and you talked about your early start in wanting to be a writer. You've been a newspaper guy. Guys all across the nation, the most respected writers in our time over the last three decades, have all started to move into multimedia spots, radio, TV. What does that say about where print is now and where it's headed?
I'd be pretentious if I sat here and tried to claim right now that I could see the future. You know, I could see into the future. But I always viewed radio as a parallel career from a young age. I think as young and dumb as I was, I still had this feeling. It's like the more things you can do, the more versatile you are, then more opportunities you'll have. So if the newspaper thing doesn't work out, hey, maybe I can do radio. So this goes back to the Baltimore days. I mean, I worked for WBAL.
Mm-hmm.
I actually was like a fill-in host. And you're talking about a 22, 23-year-old guy. I moved to St. Louis in 1985, immediately made a deal to work for KMOX, sitting in with Dan Dierdorf on Monday nights. Filling in, sitting with Mr. Jack Buck at times, being sort of the person who drove the show. He did the talking, drove the show. So you go, WBAL, huge station in Baltimore at the time, still is, KMOX. I left St. Louis to go to Dallas for a year and a half for an opportunity. Same thing, KRLD.
Right.
I co-hosted a show every Monday night and also made a lot of appearances. I come back to St. Louis, same thing. Radio became absolutely a viable career for me and a very happy career for me. And I think it's so important to give yourself as many skills, build as many skills as you can. And I think that kind of old-time newspaper people, you know, people who run newspapers still don't get it. They get it a little more. They still don't understand what's happened. And I think you've seen a lot of older guys in newspapers now that, and my heart goes out to them, but they're kind of caught flat-footed, you know, when the music stops. And it's like, well, what am I going to do now? And it's just like, I don't say this to gloat or anything, believe me. But I started hosting an online forum. And this is when, you know, frankly, when the internet started to sprout and it was still, it's funny now, it's still kind of a new thing.
Right.
I was hosting a forum, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, taking questions from readers, debating them, sometimes getting in arguments with
them. Bernie's press box was there all day.
I can't count how many writers would tell me, like, why are you wasting your time on that? You're like basically doing this for free. You're not even getting paid. You're an idiot. What are you doing this for?
Right.
Why would you subject yourself to? I say, because this is where it's heading. And I also think I'm a columnist running my mouth. It's important to be accessible to people. They feel they know you if you establish a connection.
Yep.
Even if they're mad at you, even if they get on and say you're an idiot for writing that, you're this, you're still establishing a connection. That's so important in our business.
Yep.
So I got there at the forefront of this, and I'm kind of proud of that too. And so many people laughed at me, thought I was a buffoon for wasting my time doing it.
And now they all have Twitter accounts and are engaging.
Yeah, pretty much. I sound like it. I sound like such a self-satisfied
no,
jerk.
No, it's true, because I was here. I remember how strong Bernie's press box was.
It's where everybody went.
And it was different because, you know, I came in New York. Mike Lupica wasn't doing that.
No.
Nobody was doing that.
I might have been one of the first wave on the shore, that's for sure. But no, and I thought it was important to establish it. If you're going to build a brand, you know, although back then, not that it's that long ago, back then I never sat down and said, okay, how am I going to build a brand? I didn't think about it. I just felt like, oh, hey, you know what? That's something that'll help me. I do radio. You never know. I want to be good at this. You never know.
Mm-hmm.
You never know when an opportunity might come along. If you're good enough, take advantage. This internet thing, it's like, well, I want readers to know they can get in touch with me and talk to me and even vent to me. Oh, that's a good thing. Let me use this. I never thought about it as like branding,
right.
But in effect, you add it all up and that's what it came to.
Well, because there's power in connection. If you got a connection of people who like what you do and consume it in different ways, don't matter how they're consuming it, they're essentially connected to you.
Right.
And that when you can walk into, whether it's a TV station, a radio station, or print, and say, I've got all these people behind me that are going to pay attention to my work, that's value.
Exactly. You know? So it wasn't any kind of master plan, but I just always had an instinct about this seems mm-hmm. like a smart thing to do.
You had the experience you mentioned in Baltimore and Dallas, KMOX, obviously. You were also part of the early days of St. Louis Sports Radio. You've seen this thing grow from where it was to where it is now. And I got here in 2006. I saw some of it, but that was even towards, you know, probably 10, 15 years after it had started. When you look back at those early days of St. Louis Sports Radio and where it was, what jumps out to you?
You know, this is probably true of a lot of stations today. They're really underfinanced. I worked at some places in town, and actually I savor the experiences, but I know you worked at places like this.
Oh, yeah.
You know, where you're like, wow, okay. You know, it's kind of, Spartan would be a polite term. I mean, I worked at a...
I had guys in the back room getting electrocuted because we couldn't afford an engineer.
I worked at a station in town, and it was kind of in a little bit of a dicey neighborhood. That's fine. And, you know, you'd walk in and, you know, a couple times right in the studio, you got a couple homeless people sleeping there. I'm not kidding, man. And the building had a stench, and you're like, you know what? I used to laugh. I said, you know, and there'd be the board op, and he'd be like, this is ridiculous. I said, son, it's called paying dues. So it's like, and I said, if I'm paying my dues, you can pay yours.
Right.
But you know what? I wouldn't trade that stuff for anything. It was a lot of guys just trying to find their voice, not getting paid much, Spartan working conditions. You never knew when the plug was going to be pulled.
Right.
And it's like, okay, we're racing against the clock. You know, can I build a show? Can I build a voice? Can I build a following? How do I put my stamp on this? And it was a real challenge. It was a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah.
It really was.
You did mornings on 1380. Yeah. You had also worked at 590 before that with Cusimano. And then you ultimately moved to afternoons with Randy on 1380.
Right.
I was on the KFNS side at that time. We had no signal strength on either side.
No.
No corporate support. You're just sitting there going, how long till we run out of business? It's a desperate feeling, but at the same time, you love what you're doing.
You do, and you just use the vehicle. When I say vehicle, you know, one of my favorite cars, actual cars, was an old Ford Pinto, you know, and that's one of the, remember the Ford Pinto, basically they took it off the market because they would blow up. the gas tank would blow up. So, and my parents were appalled that I bought it, but I used to love to drive that thing around. Was it a piece of, you know what? Yeah, but I loved it.
Right.
That's kind of how I look at these little, when I started out, it's some of the smaller stations in St. Louis, you know, it's my Ford Pinto, but
right.
I love it.
That's it. You know, around that time you mentioned, you know, here you have the homeless problem, no signal strength, wondering if you're going to survive. Yet at that time I'm working at KFNS and I know they're trying everything to get you over and you don't come over while Big League was running it. I'm working there.
Good thing I did.
Smart. You're talking about instincts. You had the right instinct at that time. I mean, was there anything they could have done at that time to get you to leave where you were?
No, because I don't know, man. There were some things going over there that I just kind of wanted to avoid, you know, and it's hard to explain. I had a good deal where I was. when I met with the people that owned your station, I let me just say, I didn't really hit it off with them. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
And I also, here's a story. Here's a inside ball story, too. And at that time, the station I was working for was owned by a Mormon.
Simmons, right?
Simmons, yeah. Yep. A broadcast company. And so this station started, I don't mean to like jump ahead in the story, this station where you were the original program director and built the thing and did a great job. And John Kiowski, our general manager, you know, he called me and I said, well, I'm under contract and, you know, I it's an exciting opportunity. So don't take it the wrong, I just can't right now. And he said, well, you never know, you know, there might be a way to work something out. So basically what happened, I kind of knew there's a chance something could work out. At this time, our station, 101 ESPN, was owned by Bonneville, another Mormon company.
Right.
So basically, out there in Salt Lake, the two Mormon-owned radio companies like made a deal. They traded my contract. So
what did Utah acquire for the rights to Bernie Miklas?
I know. It's like I was traded. I mean, you know, and traded by Mormons,
right.
You know, in Salt Lake. It's like, that's really kind of funny.
Those
looking.
Things happen more than people
know,
even know. It's crazy.
I don't think you guys had to give up anything for
no,
me.
No, probably not.
You were willing to pay me.
Right, and they were probably looking
they
to
were
shed
broke.
Salary.
Yeah, they were broke. That was a salary dump.
So here, I want to go back to that time, because when 101's being built, I get the job. It's September of 2008. The station's launching January 1, 2009. And I get called. John Kiowski gives me the job. And do you remember our first conversation before you came here?
I don't know if this is what you're talking about. When you and I didn't know each other at all.
I mean,
I know of you. You knew of me. But I would always hear, you know, this guy Barrett, man, he's ridiculous. He you know, he's always on everybody's case. He's always pushing. It's like nothing's good enough. And guy's a pain in the ass to work for, and this and that, and this and that, and this and that. So I told Kiowski, who called me, I said, you know, I don't think I can work for this guy. I don't think I could work for this guy because it's just, I hear terrible things. And Kiowski's like, well, look, he's done great work. And yeah, he can be abrasive, but he makes people better. You should at least talk to him. You can't just say you can't work for a guy. He was absolutely right. And you and I had, it was a Saturday morning, I think. It was a very long conversation, and we hit it off.
Yep.
You know what I figured out? I mean this, and you know this. You and I are wired the same way.
Right.
You're intense, and you push, and nothing's going to be good enough. You don't settle. It's like, how do I get better? How do I get better? Through my career, I've always had this underdog mentality, radio and newspapers. It's like people say, oh, that was great. No, it wasn't. And it's just like I'm pushing my producer, driving him crazy. I'm pushing this. I'm pushing that. Because it's like, do you want to just collect a paycheck until somebody tells you, well, you're gone? Or do you really want to try to be good? It doesn't mean that you will be good.
Yep.
You want to make the best of this, or is this just a paycheck? You're that way. I'm that way. And that's the irony in this. I learned more from you than anybody I've ever worked for in any media platform. It includes newspaper. I learned more from you more than anybody that I ever worked for. And it's because of your drive and your insistence on, look, we have to raise our standards. We have to get better. But also, you were a guy, you still are. If I was pissed off about something, I could come in and tell you exactly what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to pull a punch. You would understand, hey, this guy's working his tail off. I want him to feel like he can open this door at any time, even if they holler at me.
Right.
You could. So the communication with you was always so open and honest. And that's the way I think it's got to be. So it's funny because here, I can never work for this guy. Turned out to be the best guy I ever worked for.
Right. When you were talking about the pressure of performing on deadline earlier.
Yeah.
That's how I went to work every day. We're number one, how are we going to stay there? If we're number two, how are we going to number one? And I remember when Kiowski first brought that up, I said, actually, I love that. You know what? Because he's being honest, and he should feel that way. He hasn't worked with me. I love it. It's a challenge. I said, I'm not bothered by that at all. I actually welcome it because it's an opportunity to break down walls and develop a relationship.
Right.
And I think over time, we'll get there. And he's like, you're taking this a lot better than I thought you would. I said, no, because why would you? You only know what you read and what other people tell you. I can't blame a guy for thinking that. And then what happens? We wind up working together. And we have a lot of success together.
And we find out there's a lot of things in common in terms of our attitude about stuff. And I didn't realize it at the time, but it's like, you and I probably have the same view of this too. And again, I'm going to sound like a jerk, but it's like, but I think even now there's still too many people that look at radio as like, okay, let me just go in there and talk for a couple hours, get paid, everything else. And I think the reason why I heard so many bad things about you, you pushed back. You didn't want to run a radio station where, frankly, people were lazy. And let's go to the phone calls. I like the fact that when I came here, the policy was basically no phone calls. You could solicit voicemails. I would get some backlash from listeners, fans, critics, whatever, say, oh, see, you're afraid to take phone calls. You don't want anyone to disagree with you. And it wasn't it at all. My answer to that is like, they pay me to do the show. They don't pay a caller who's going to call in every day and say the same thing. You know, this is my job. Mm-hmm. This is why I'm getting paid. I got to come up with an interesting list of topics to talk about for 3 hours. I don't expect callers to do my work for me. Now, that said, I still disagree with you guys mm-hmm. on this a little mm-hmm. bit. I think there's a time and place to take calls, so I'm going to push for that change.
Yeah, no, listen, no, I agree. I'm a big believer, especially when you're launching a station in a market where there's already an established brand. You're the new brand on the scene. If they're known for calls on the other side of the aisle, then don't start that way. That doesn't mean you stay that way for eternity. When we launched in San Francisco, did the same thing that I did here. Hey, I want to focus on good content. We can interact on text and Twitter. And then ultimately, as we go, we'll start adding calls. But we don't want to set the expectation that we are the same exact kind of brand as what people already have. And when you look at St. Louis, KMOX had done a lot of calls. You had
right.
KFNS and KTRS doing calls. I just said, look, let's make it about the personalities.
I love what I'm doing, but do people want to listen to one guy talking for 3 hours? You know, mm-hmm. I don't have a co-host. My producer chimes in here and there, but mm-hmm. you know, it's not a thing where I'm going to, you know, lean on him too much. To this day, I still wonder, you know, do people really want to hear me talk for 3 hours?
Mm-hmm.
And I say, should I mix phone calls in? Maybe like what Feinbaum does, even though I can never replicate that,
mm-hmm.
where your callers sort of become the other person. I mean, you're having some interaction. I still wrestle with that very, mm-hmm. very much. I understand why it's good to have me do a solo show, because I have a lot of opinions and I prepare like a madman and always find, I think, good stuff to talk about. And, you know, business is good, so I think I can carry it. But I still, to this day, have doubts about that.
I think with you, it's impossible to put a quote-unquote co-host with, because you are a dominant figure as a host. You are going to command 80 to 90% of the airtime because you have a lot of opinions and you like to pontificate and you like to stretch your content, which, look, if you're doing 45 minutes an hour, I don't want a guy with short on opinion. I want a guy with a lot of opinion.
Right.
So I don't think you need a co-host, where there are some other guys who probably do 40-50% and benefit from that. Like, I think most shows are the most entertaining when you have two or three people on, but there are guys that, like yourself, like Mike Francesa hasn't had a co-host in a long time in New York. He's doing pretty well.
He does like 20 hours a
right.
day.
Oh,
that's what
exactly.
It seems that way anyway.
And,
yeah.
And he's got plenty to say. And so if you're wired that way, and you are, then I think it works.
But he
know?
Takes a lot of calls too.
Yeah,
and
he
the
does.
Callers are part of the show. So, I mean, that's kind of...
I agree that I think there are cases where, and look, in your case, I think there are times where it absolutely makes sense to take calls. There are days where it probably doesn't. You know, it depends what the story is. I think what happens sometimes is once you start opening the floodgates, some sure. guys think, okay, now let's take a ton of calls.
It's
and
a crutch.
It's a mixture.
A yeah.
You know, I will say this, there's always more entertainment value hearing someone's voice rather than hearing a host read a text or a tweet. That being said, I don't want the show to get sidetracked where a guy is talking to a caller for 5-6 minutes and getting off the rails or following their lead versus driving the content and having the audience react to them
right.
because it's the host who's in control. This station that you're at, 101 ESPN, was built with the expectation that the personalities drive the show. They're the ones who you're taking your cue from. And look, it's worked well for you guys. Like, the
no,
shows have done really well. So I think, like anything, though, you can always evolve and add to it. There's nothing wrong with that. It just comes down to finding that balance.
It's got to be disciplined.
Yes.
And the way I would see this is that you have what everybody would agree would be a hot button issue that is very, very relevant with your audience. I mean, it's important to your audience. Like, should the Cardinals make a managerial change? We're going to go to your calls next segment, but I'm telling you right now, here are the phone numbers. I want you to get to the point,
mm-hmm.
give your take, and we're going to move it along. It isn't a matter of training an audience, because I think that sounds like you're talking about, you know, you're trying to teach a dog where to go to the bathroom mm-hmm. or something. It's not that. But I think when they know what the expectations are, then they're going to say, well, yeah, okay, this is how he likes to do it. This is the way it should be done. So, yeah, let me think of what I want to say when I get on, boom, 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 you know. we'll have a great conversation. Otherwise, I'm going to move on. So
what's funny about that is, so sports radio in the early days was all about open funds. You tell us where you want us to go, we go there, yeah. Right? And that's what I think where we were starting is avoiding that.
Right, you were.
It's about, hey, guys, we're talking about whether Mike Matheny should be back. This is what we want response on. Like, it's not revolutionary. Put on CNN. What's your reaction to President Trump's comments? They don't tell you, you know, here's what they think about a local senator race. It's about the Trump comments, right? So it's the same thing. It's just saying, look, guys, we're trying to guide a conversation in a certain direction. This is what the host's hot on. We want you involved, but we want you involved right now on this. We don't want to know what you think the Blues expectations are for the season, because that sidetracks the show.
But I think as long as you're disciplined about it, it doesn't become a crutch. And frankly, you're not going to have the same voices every day unless they're incredible callers and you say, yeah, I wish that person would call. But no. And if you just say, okay, we're talking about this, we're going to stay on a topic. That's it. No exceptions. Right. I think you can make it work even at our station. So something for me to think about going forward, but the boss probably won't want to hear that.
You were talking before about the way we're both wired and from an intense standpoint, always taking our work seriously and always striving for more. One thing that's really been impressive about you and that you probably don't get enough credit for, you keep producers around for a long time. Like Ben Boyd was with you a long time. Michelle Smallman, who's now producing Russillo, was with you for a long time.
Right.
You've now got Travis Green. What do you look for out of a producer and how do you show that they're involved in it and it matters?
That's a great question. It's a tough question because when Ben Boyd became my producer, became a dear friend of mine, he is to this day, I was still trying to juggle two careers at the time. I was still the lead sports columnist at the Post-Dispatch, but I was doing the show. But I didn't want to do a lazy show. I wanted the show to be good. I didn't want to steal anybody's money, you know? But the responsibilities were different, I think. It's just, look, I need some guests. Here's what I want to talk about. You know, I didn't really ask them to do a lot of prep because I was doing 2 hours and 3 hours. It's just really hard to explain. It's just different because it wasn't my full-time vocation. And I'm not saying I'm cutting corners, but you just had to make choices about, I only have so many hours during the day. I don't have time maybe to train the producer the way I want to. The program director has to train and coach producers a lot, but I guess because I wasn't all in with the radio station, even though I cared about it, I was just going to say, well, I'm going to leave that stuff to other people. I don't. It's not a good answer, but I really expect that if we're going to have guests, they got to count. I don't want guests just to have guests. Make it count. Make it important. Make them relevant. I was pretty demanding on guests. The show prep, not so much, but I would appreciate any help that I got. Michelle was great on the air, so she was a real asset to the show because you're right. I mean, it's a solo show, but when people hear the producer chime in, I like to have a producer talks on the air and can throw his or her piece in. Ben Boyd wasn't like that. Travis, you know, we're working with him. He would say, you know, he doesn't feel like totally comfortable yet, ready yet. So that's not a shot. It's just it is what it is. Everybody's got a different skill set. Michelle was great because you could have some fun and she knew her stuff and she knew how to basically give it to me, like basically take a shot at me, which was hysterical and listeners loved it. So she brought a different skill set than Ben Boyd did. Travis is a workhorse. He's a great guest booker. This will be funny if he listens to this. But no, he's got to raise his game in terms of, you know, when you're talking about ideas, I always say to him, all right, anybody can do a segment saying Tom Brady's a great quarterback.
Surface stuff.
Yeah. Next level.
Right.
Next level. He's a resilient guy because I push him, not because I'm a jerk, but because I think a host has to make the producer better. I think I have an obligation to make him better and to make him good. I mean, he's working for me. He's working his tail off. I feel what I can do for him is to hopefully make him better, and one day he'll understand. This is why I say no to, like, 9 out of every 10 ideas. It isn't because I don't want his ideas. It isn't because I think they're crap. It's just that, no, I do a different kind of show. You got something there, but you got to think of it, all right, what's the next level of this? Because every Tom, Dick, and Harry's talking about the first level. What's the next level? Let's get it to the next level. Let's evolve that idea. He's starting to figure that out. It's really gratifying, actually. And, you know, the thing about him, too, and all three of those producers you mentioned were like this. I could get on them, but I would just say, that's not good enough. I need this. this sounds like an old man again. You know, a lot of younger people, you know, they don't want to hear that. I've been fortunate that Ben Boyd understood, you know, the fact that I just was, you know, really driven to have a great show. And I was going to work my tail off, so I expected them to be as dedicated as I was. Michelle was the same way. You and I basically hired her, and, you know, to me, she's a star. I mean, so, mm-hmm. you know, I'm really proud of that. And Travis is the same way, too. The coolest thing about Travis, and the only reason I'm talking about this is if we have other people listening, say, how to host, how should you coach your producers, how far should you go, what kind of style? You know, first of all, when they do something good, you should always praise them. Second of all, if you get on their tail and you push and push and push and say that's not good enough, you need to tell them, dude, you may hate me today. I'm doing it to make you better. I want you to have a great career. We're not going to work together forever. I want you to be like Ben Boyd, who goes from my show to the MLB Network mm-hmm. and to KMOX is basically someone who coordinates their Cardinals broadcast. I want you to be like Michelle Smallman, who gets an opportunity at ESPN in Bristol. Mm-hmm. I want that for you. If I let you languish, if I let you maintain areas where, you know, you really need to improve at, if I just let that pass without pushing you to get better, then I'm failing you as a coworker, but I'm also failing you as a friend. He gets it, and some people don't. He gets it. Every time, you know, I'll say, look, man, this or that, and I'll email him later and say, look, man, you know what I told you. We're only trying to make you better. That's my only motivation here. And he thanks me, and he'll even sort of cut me off at they say, look, man, I get it. I want you to make me better. So anything you throw at me in the lungs, I not only can handle it, I want it. So mm-hmm. we've reached that understanding. I think it's really important for hosts to take ownership of their producers and their careers. Look, first of all, if you make a producer better, the host benefits. Don't you want to have people that work with you, if they're young especially and just starting, don't you want them to have success? I do.
Like, look, when I worked with Dan Patrick, it drives you nuts as a producer. Like, nothing works. Nothing pleases this guy. But then what you learn as you're going along is, like, one, every producer wants to feel validated right. that, okay, the host does like what I bring to the table, right? So you're looking for that personal validation. But you also start to develop this mentality that it's just like baseball, man. I'm going to miss 7 out of 10 times, but if I get 3 hits... I'm in the Hall of Fame. First of all, if you like every idea, there's a problem. There's probably a lot of crap hitting the air.
Right.
You know, it's okay to like, hey, this is not good enough push because it makes people better, and there's nothing wrong with that. I want to ask you, speaking of getting better, the St. Louis Rams leave this market,
yeah.
move to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
That's usually a crippler for a sports station.
Right.
This sports station goes up. This sports station is in double-digit shares. Your morning show is consistently among the top 3 or 4. The station as a whole is in the top 3. How does that happen when a city loses a football team?
Well, first of all, I think we've established ourselves as kind of like the franchise player in St. Louis Sports Talk Radio. I don't say that arrogantly. We just have. And look, you ain't going to lie. It helps to have a booming signal. Some of the stations here, their mission's challenged that way. So I think we're living in an FM world. It's not AM, and that doesn't mean you can't have good shows on AM. Of course you can. But it's a built-in advantage. I think we take advantage of it. But I think part of it is that they, hopefully the listeners know that, you know, because the Rams left, we weren't going to, you know, get all hound dog and not show up, go to work or to be like, well, what do we do now? I don't know what we do now. You know, we were just, it was going to be like business as usual. We're going to come to work, find other things to talk about, go forward. You know, I developed on my show an NFL strategy as soon as the Rams left. All right, how am I going to do? I was thinking months ahead. What am I going to do during training camp? What am I going to do during the season? What's the format? How much do we hit? What do we talk about? What are some segments that we can, some benchmark stuff we can come up with? And we covered the league. We covered this first season without the Rams as we would if we were in an NFL city. You didn't have a team there, but it's like my whole thing is like, nothing's changes. It's football America.
Right.
Nothing has changed. It's going to keep going. Let's go. I think by not drawing attention to it and almost kind of like grieving or mourning, or you don't want to be dug down. Or it's like, oh, man, there's still things to talk about. People watch football. They gamble on football.
Mm-hmm.
They play fantasy football. It's still very, very important. It's better when there's a team because you got built-in material.
Right.
That was the challenge. You know, you're losing a lot of automatic built-in material.
Right.
You had to go out and cultivate material. So the job became a little more difficult, but I never gave it much thought. I know that's I don't even really have a great answer for you. I think part of it, too, is you said, man, I'm established in town for better or worse. Everyone, you know, everybody knows who Bernie is. The fast lane, those guys are all established. You know, Kevin Wheeler's been in this town for a long time. Chris Duncan, Brad Thompson, Anthony Stalter's made a name. People come to us because they feel like they know us. And just because the Rams left, it doesn't mean that they're going to sever their relationship with us. We're with them. We're standing together on this thing. So I think, again, we talked about it earlier. When you establish that connection, it carries you through tough times.
I want to talk to you about tough times and connections because being a lifelong media guy here, Brian Burwell, Joe Strauss, two really good friends of yours that you worked with and obviously were gone too soon. But how did that change you from a personal and professional standpoint? Because those guys were guys you spent a lot of time with in press boxes, traveling with, two of the very best in their business. How did that affect you from a personal and professional standpoint?
It was jarring in a number of ways, and personally more than anything. But I have to say, because you miss them. You know, and it's funny because Burwell's like one of the two or three nicest people I ever worked with. I mean, total class act. And his columnists, I've seen situations where columnists at the same paper in some markets, they don't get along. They hate each other's guts. I always looked at that and I thought, man, life's too short. Why are columnists getting into these ego battles? Burwell and I had two arguments, you know, not arguments where we're hollering, but two disagreements. I think I was wrong both times. We got along great and we made trades. We made compromises. He loves football. I do too, but he wasn't as much as a baseball guy. He'd say, hey, man, I know you like to do this. You do this. I'll cover this. We always work together. So I just miss the relationship and knowing what it's like to have a teammate like that. He was just a great guy. And Joe Strauss, the interesting thing about Joe, and I'm not speaking poorly of Joe, trust me, but you know him. Joe was irascible, and he was a curmudgeon, and he poked his stick. And there were times you were like, you know, what is up with this guy? You know, why is he always like starting trouble?
Nickname El Diablo.
Yeah, and it's at times, you know, like I said when he passed away, and people who worked with Joe and knew him understood exactly what I meant. I said, you know, it wasn't always easy to be his friend, but there was something unique and special about the guy because he challenged everything and you couldn't fool him. You couldn't con him. Sometimes that would come back on you. He'd make fun of you for being Mr. Pollyanna, you know, I missed that spice, man, that snark. I mean, that's the thing about having three columns when we were working together. All three of our personalities were different. And it really worked. Mm-hmm. It really worked. But let me tell you something. You know, it got me to thinking, too, about my career. And it's hard to explain because I don't want to trivialize their passing by saying, well, you know, because of them, you know, I did this. You know, or I decided, I could go make more money in radio. And it wasn't that at all. It was just that I've always wanted to know what it was like to cut that tie that has been almost like my whole adult life has been such a huge part of my life, but I don't like the way newspapers are going. I don't like the way it's not the people in the newsroom. It's the people that own the companies. I can't stand what's happened. I can't stand seeing my friends hurt. I can't see, you know, hardworking people who do great work get laid off for no reason, cutbacks, slashing a budget for nothing more than just greed. I started to hate the business, not journalism, but the business part of it. And I just say, you know, but I just can't break away. I had chances to go full-time radio, write for, you know, the station site. Never could break away. I couldn't cut the cord. So when those two guys died relatively, you know, in short time of each other, you know, it's just like, what are you waiting for? I mean, if you really feel an urge at your career to try something different, it's like, think about Brian, think about Joe, think about their goals, not only professionally, but personally, their families, this, that. If there's something you want to do in life, you better take advantage of it while you can. And I think that was part of my thinking when I did finally cut the cord, you know, because you never know. Mm-hmm. You never know. These media companies just continue to just napalm the village and it's a demoralizing kind of climate. But it was a risk involved too, man. I'm not saying, hey, you know, Hubbard's great. And believe me, I researched Hubbard and what they're all about and what they stand for, what their approach, and we're simpatico. And I trust this company and I trusted this situation. But some people thought I was nuts.
Right.
So you're a columnist. You know, there's always going to be a Post-Dispatch around, even if it's online. I mean, why are you walking away from a sure thing? Again, because why wait if you want to try something different? You spent all these years building up a brand name or whatever it is. Ride with it. Have confidence in yourself.
By taking that risk, last year you were rewarded for it because I polled every PD and corporate executive in America, and they reward you and recognized you as having the best mid-market morning show in America. Well, I mean, what was great. That morning like when you got that news?
It was really nice because, I mean, look, I don't care who anybody is. I mean, they, you know, they can lie, but they're not telling the truth. Of course you want to be respected and liked. I mean, there are going to be times where that's impossible because you're going to have an unpopular opinion. You're going to make people mad. No one has 100% approval rating. It'll never happen. But yeah, of course we all want to be viewed as someone who does a good job. And any encouragement is good too. I mean, any encouragement just motivates me. I'm that type. Mm-hmm. You know, it just makes me want to do even more, be even better. And that's been one of the great things about making this switch. I can throw myself into this full time. Now, I write a lot, too. I mean, I write an awful lot.
Yep.
And I always will because it's in my blood. But I was able to, the first time in my career, in a long career, to throw myself into radio full time. And it's made me a lot better because of it. I mean, I really get the business now. I understand what works, what doesn't, the way you find your voice. What I have found is, like, I don't know why, maybe it's psychological, JB, but come into this full time, my only employer and all that, and this is what I have to do. And actually, my survival depends on it because I better be good and I better be bringing money in here and ratings. You lose your inhibitions, mm-hmm. You know, and I would say before, you know, because, like, well, I'm working for the Post-Dispatch and, geez, I don't know. You know, there's a little bit of that, you know.
Right.
Now it's like, you know what, this is my career, this is my station, this is my show, I'm going to say what I want, mm-hmm. Let's get after it, you know?
Right.
And it doesn't mean that I was being a phony before, but it's like tough to serve two masters. There are politics involved. Maybe the people I work for at the newspaper didn't want to hear me like going nuts on the radio when I'm all hot about something or saying, well, why didn't you write that in your column, you know?
Right.
You're always sort of making those little like, well, I didn't write that, so maybe I shouldn't go off on that,
yeah.
You know? Now it's like, let's go, you know?
Right. Or the radio guy's going, is he only talking about this because he wrote a column on it?
Yeah, exactly, you know, exactly. You know, now it's like, let's go. Let's get this done. You know,
now you're not having to overthink it. You just do what you feel.
Exactly. And it's nice to have your inhibitions just completely busted up and to kind of really, really develop a voice and a personality. And I'm having a ball. I mean, I probably don't get enough sleep, but I'm having a ball.
I'm going to wrap up on a thing I call quick hits in a second. But okay. I bet you were talking about getting better, so I want to bust your balls on one thing.
All right.
So in most towns, there's like you talked earlier about how columnists have this media beef, right? And there's you see it with radio hosts in a lot of places. You don't have that, though.
No.
But you do have this one arch nemesis called the programming clock, right?
I do.
So at the same time, one of your best attributes is that you have good content, so it doesn't really matter. But what's your views on a programming clock?
Let me tell you something, man. It's my biggest failure in this business, and I go home every day and I say, look, now tomorrow it's going to get better. By the way, this week's been much better, maybe because you're here. I know the specter of JB's hovering over the studio.
I always tell Bernie in the room, look, you can break 50 times late, just take it down to 40. We'll win in the ratings. I'm giving you 40 excuses to get out.
No, look, I probably definitely hurts or affects my ratings because of the way this is. This is all such a stupid system anyway.
It is.
And you know what? And I think I got to be honest. I, again, you know how I told you at the beginning of this conversation? It's not like I had a plan. It's not like I said, oh, well, okay, I got to do this because 20 years from now, this. No, but it's instinctual. And I've always had a bit of a maverick streak in me. People with the surprises some people, they may not think so. Part of it is like I actually do think the rating system is kind of stupid. And I know people cheat to get ratings. And I don't like the system. And the other thing is that even though I am a full-time radio guy, and this is my vocation and my life, and I love it, and I want to be great at it, there's part of me that's like, you know what? I'm going to be raw. I'm going to be natural. And I've said this on the air, like even people listening to this are saying, boy, he's stammering a little bit. Well, first of all, it's because I need to go home and take a nap. I've been up since 2:30. That's why. And I'm tired. But no, part of it is that, you know, I said this about 2 weeks ago, because I'll get an email saying, you know, you know your stuff, but you stammer, you know, and you do this and you do that and you get excited and your voice goes up. It's like you should try to become more polished. My answer to that is, the day you hear me sound like somebody where there's 25 of those guys in every market, get me out of here,
right?
Because I'm just someone off the assembly line. See, what's going to work in radio going forward, I do understand this. You have to be unique. And you have to be what you are. You have to be someone that listeners, a potential audience, they're not going to be able to find anywhere else. You got to be who you are. Mm-hmm. If I sound like some polished, prefabbed, manufactured broadcaster, that's not me.
Right.
So getting back to the clock, if I'm fired up about something, no, I'm not going to tap the brakes. I'm going to keep going. Let's go. Let's ride this out. So maybe I'm delusional. In some way, I think it adds to my appeal. I may be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I break the rules.
My challenge with you is never about stop breaking the rules. It was just try not to break them as much, because it's all about a tenth of a point. Yes, the rating system sucks. You're absolutely right, but let's play the game so you can get paid more.
I know. That's right. No, but don't you understand what I'm saying? I mean, you know more about this business than I do. With all the competition out there, you know, and people always say radio's dying, which is, from what I can tell, is, you know, nonsense. But it is more of a challenge. There's more places to go for information, entertainment. What do we have? Okay, if you have a bunch of shows where pretty much they all sound alike, okay, are you separating yourself? Are you becoming a viable option when people have 20 other choices? But if you are who you are, and maybe you sound different, and maybe you do stammer, and maybe you do holler, and maybe you do raise your voice, and maybe you do go on these rants, maybe you do make fun of yourself, maybe you say to hell with it, I'm not taking a break. Maybe that makes you different. Maybe that gives you just a little bit more of a unique touch. I don't know.
All right, I want to wrap up on a couple of quick hits. The first thought that pops to your mind, four questions, and we'll put a bow on this. One piece of advice for an aspiring young sports writer today would be?
Two things. Number one, work your ass off. There's never a replacement for that. People forget that part. Number two, make yourself as versatile as possible. Try to conquer as many platforms in the media as you can. Don't be one-dimensional.
The best part of working for PD Jason Barrett was?
He made me better. I would want to strangle him, and I would go home and squawk to my wife. This guy's driving me crazy, but it's just like I worked for one of the great sports editors ever in Dallas, and I wanted to go home. I wanted to strangle him, too. He made me better, and you appreciate it after the fact. You made me better, man. That's all I can say.
The worst part of working for PD Jason Barrett.
Drove me crazy. Absolutely drove me crazy at times. I don't like to hear about ratings, so I would hate it when he would because a book would come in, and one time the number was like ridiculously high, and I said, no, that's false. I'm not going to buy into it. Don't congratulate me, because it's not real.
Right.
A couple books later, I had this unusually low number, so I'm like, you know what? I don't want to hear it, because this is artificially low. It's an outlier. Something's not right. The Jason Barrett, I'd drive me crazy, you know, would have these comprehensive breakdowns of ratings, and I wanted to like basically print out the email and burn it as soon as I got it. Anyway, go ahead. Because it gets me to think too much.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to know. I just want to do what I do, you know?
Here's what I wanted. Did he see he's in the top three? Did he cash a bonus check? If I got him there, we're good. Final quick hit.
Yeah, they're not so quick with me.
Yeah, it's
so
okay. Anyway. The best sports radio host in St. Louis, not named Bernie Miklas, is who?
You know who I think does a great job. And I also know it's because he's prepared. He's well-versed on every sport. He runs the clocks great. His formatics are great. He's a talent that's getting better and better and better. Anthony Stalter. I really, really dig Anthony Stalter. And it doesn't mean I don't dig everybody else.
Right.
But you asked me, and that's the answer.
No, it's great. You could hear Bernie Miklas weekday morning, 7 to 10 on 101 ESPN in St. Louis. This has been a blast, my friend. I appreciate you taking the time and sacrificing some sleep.
Good to see you, JB. Thanks for having me.
This is the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
My thanks once again to Bernie Miklas. Among the areas we covered in that conversation, I especially loved his feedback on the print business and the importance of staying ahead of the curve and not being afraid to take a risk with your career. His points about having confidence in yourself and life being too short to look back and say, why didn't I do something? that really connected with me because I've taken those steps myself, and although they can be scary, they also tend to be more fulfilling. His thoughts on the host and producer relationship were also excellent. Having worked with Bernie, I can tell you, he's an intense guy. He takes his work seriously, and sometimes that can be intimidating for a young producer. But when you hear him talk about his role in making sure he makes his people better and not wanting to fail them as a coworker and friend, that's the type of mindset every program director wants out of every one of their employees. The discussions we had on navigating the clock and taking phone calls, I also thought provided some quality perspective because while every host and PD has a style, vision, and reason for their positions, you learn as you go that there's no one-size-fits-all formula for doing this. You can win in a number of different ways, and if there's anything to be learned, it's not to be so stuck in your ways that you fail to evolve and miss opportunities to strengthen your show or radio station. I hope you guys enjoyed that. But that's all the time we have for this week's episode. For the next episode, my featured guest will be the founder and chairman of VSiN, the Vegas Stats and Information Network, Brian Musburger. If you're not familiar with VSiN, the network launched in February and features Brent Musburger. It's a fully dedicated network to sports gambling, and I think you'll find Brian's story to be pretty interesting. If your brand is looking to stay ahead of the pack or catch up to the competition, I do work as a sports media consultant and strategist. To find out how I can help your group, visit my website, sportsradiopd.com. My contact and services are listed there. In the words of Kid Rock, if it looks good, you'll see it. If it sounds good, you'll hear it. If it's marketed right, you'll buy it. But if it's real, you'll feel it. So be authentic in everything you do. Until next time, I'm Jason Barrett. Thanks for stopping by.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, sportsradiopd.com.